This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In the developing world, people work as street vendors, scavengers, and servants, anything to feed their families. Today, we take a look at some of the unusual ways people make a living around the globe. In a small African village, peanut butter provides a way out of poverty.
Before the peanut butter project, life was grim. We had to go out in search of work. There was no income and people were poor.
And Indian women rent their wombs to childless couples in the West. Plus, a taxi driver steers clear of trouble in Kenya's crime-ridden capital.
This is very dangerous. I just don't want to clothe myself in fear and then not able to pay my bills, not able to have food. So you take risk.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Most of us do it. We work to earn a living. Some of us even have the luxury of loving the work we do. But that's rare in the developing world. Work isn't always easy to come by, and wages are often as low as a dollar a day. On our show today, we're taking a look at work in the developing world. Sometimes it's dangerous, sometimes it's innovative and fun, and sometimes it's just plain desperate. Just south of the border in Mexico, one in six children works to help their families. Child labor is illegal, and there have been many campaigns to end it, but not all children who work are forced into it. Some, like the two you're about to hear from, take pride in what they do. Conrad Fox reports from a small village in Veracruz, Mexico.
8-year-old David, his 11-year-old sister Karina, and their mother Berna hike down a muddy country road. Between them, they lug a big bag of sweaters, jeans, skirts, socks, and underwear. They brought it from the city of Jalapa, where they live, about half an hour away by bus. Now, they hope to sell the clothes in the farming villages around here. Berna says that with luck, they make about $600 a month doing this. Berna and the children have been making this trip two or three times a week for the last 6 years. As they enter the village of Plan de Cedeño, Berna sends the children off on their own with some clothes, while she heads to see another client. She says she never insists that her children work, and they rarely miss school to come here. But she is clearly glad of the help.
Karina's really tough on clients that don't pay. She fights with them. I'm not doing this for fun, she tells them. I'm doing this because I have to. Since they were young, they've loved selling. It's good for them. They'll just get into bad habits if they're not busy.
The children have come across local man Don Pepe. He's interrupted his farm chores to carefully select two pairs of new underwear from a bag David offers him. 11-year-old Karina reminds him he still has outstanding debts with them. How much? She pulls out a notebook and, in what looks like a well-practiced routine, her 8-year-old brother bends over to let her lean on his back. With a little help from this reporter, Karina does the math. Don Pepe owes 105 pesos and gives her 20. I'll get you another payment next week, he says. It's not much, but Karina is proud to take something back to her mother.
If my mom says, go tell them they've got 2 weeks to pay, I just tell them 1 week. The other day, me and Dave went up the road there to collect, and we came back with 110 pesos. My mom was there too, and she hardly came back with anything.
But for all their pride, the experience of working has not always been positive. Until recently, David also worked at an auto body shop and earned about $6 a week for 15 hours of work. The low wages didn't bother him, but the chemicals used on the job did. He got very sick and had to quit. Now, he earns extra money selling candies to his classmates at school. But he's not resentful that he has to work to help his family.
None of my friends work. They're lazy. They just go straight home from school every day.
On the final stop of the day, Berna sells a skirt and collects some overdue payments. Again, David leans over and lets Karina work out the bill on his back. Then Karina asks her mother for some of the profits, to buy candy. She's not ashamed about spending some of the profits on small luxuries. It's thanks to this job, she says, that the family lives as they do.
I don't care. I spend a lot. because when I was young, I just had 3 changes of clothes and 2 pairs of shoes. My dad had hardly any money.
Still, her mother gives her nothing. It'll spoil her dinner, she scolds. A dinner paid by all 3 of them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Plan de Cedeño, Mexico.
From Mexico to Malawi, people are on the lookout for ways to improve their lives. In Puleng, South Africa, it was plain old peanut butter that came to the rescue. The women from that tiny village are singing the praises of peanut butter. The ordinary brown paste has brought extraordinary change to their tiny village. A few years ago, there was virtually no work there, no opportunity, and no hope. Now that's all changed, Sonia Varma reports.
It's hard to see Catherine Mahumbe's face as she leans over to grind 2 stones together. This is the ancestral, arm-making way of making peanut butter. For generations, women have used this grinding technique to make the paste, a traditional food in many parts of Africa. 7 years ago, Catherine and a few other women in her village decided to try to make a living by starting a small peanut butter business. In those early days, they'd grind for 8 hours every day.
8 o'clock to 4 o'clock.
We would start grinding at 8 o'clock until 4 o'clock. To make 4 kilos of peanut butter. We were 7. Just imagine 7 people producing just 4 kilos of peanut butter after a whole day.
That's only about 9 pounds. The women made just enough peanut butter to supply the local school, their one buyer. And even though the business wasn't exactly the height of productivity, the women weren't complaining. They knew things could be worse.
Before the peanut butter project, life was grim. We had to go out in search of work, and I would leave my kids at home. There was no income, and people were poor.
Catherine was unemployed, so she and her 5 kids were living off her mother's pension of about $110 a month. There was never enough money or food to go around. Her children had empty bellies and shabby clothes. Many others in this tiny village of 2,000 were not much better off. But Catherine wasn't about to let herself be a victim of circumstance.
I had a dream that I could do something with the women of the village, especially since the school kids needed to be looked after. I wanted to group the women closer to where the school kids were, so that when they finished classes, we could properly look after them.
The women brainstormed business ideas, everything from selling clay pots to basket weaving. But Catherine put forward the idea of making peanut butter. Now, the village of Puleng, where the women live, is hardly full of fertile fields. The soil is dry and rocky. But one thing hardy enough to grow there are peanuts. So the women unanimously agreed, a peanut butter business it would be. For 2 years, they grinded away in a room borrowed from the local school. Then, in 1999, the aid agency Africare agreed to build a factory and donate hand grinders to the fledgling business. Eventually, with a grant from Africare, the women purchased a diesel-powered grinder. Remember how the women used to slave away to make just 9 pounds of peanut butter per day? The diesel engine pumps out 12 times that amount in just a fraction of the time.
50 kg. 45 minutes.
Today, the business known as the Kudmela Trading Cooperative has branched out its customer base, selling at the local market. The business brings in $150 a day. It employs 7 full-time workers and a number of seasonal workers who tend to the peanut fields. Catherine says the steady income has changed the life of her family and others in the most basic of ways. She pulls at her skin.
In the past, it was dry and shrinking. Now, thanks to peanut butter, it's shining. Kids and old people are looking better, looking healthy.
To say the factory has changed these women's lives doesn't truly get to the heart of the matter. The women, all at least middle-aged, had little in the way of education. Only two of the founding members can read and write. The women most certainly would have been relegated to a life of laboring away for someone else for little money. But with the factory, they've become breadwinners and bosses.
People come to us asking for work. We have the ability to hire.
Madipola Mamaila is one of the project's seven full-time workers and a founding member.
Before, I worked an hour away on a white man's farm, and I was leaving my kids home alone. Now with the peanut butter project, I can keep a close eye on my children's well-being, see how they're doing in school.
On the farm, Madibolo only made $10 a month. The factory pays her nine times that amount. The future of the peanut butter business appears bright. The local tribal authority has just given additional land to the project. That will mean more peanuts and more jobs. Back at the factory, the women sing as they pack plastic bottles full of the spread. It's a local tune, but they've changed the lyrics so they can pay tribute to what else? Peanut butter. The song says, "Women, stop talking unnecessarily. You need to work hard. Using your hands, you can make a good peanut butter to feed your family." For the World Vision Report, I'm Sonia Varma in Pulang, South Africa.
Coming up, custom-made coffins are big business in Ghana.
Loved ones are buried in a coffin custom designed to reflect the dead person's trade. A carpenter might be buried in a giant hammer, a minister in a giant Bible.
That and more coming up on the World Vision Report. Stay with us.
Keep the home fires burning. What Papa's earning, the pittance he calls his pay. You gotta get up so early in the morning to keep your job, let alone find one these days. Hear them sing in the street now. Hear the sound of marching feet now. Sfunum Sevens, work for all. We need to work to be seen. Sfunum Sevens, there's a jobless army in the streets. Sfunum Sevens, in a wage of hidden war. Sfunum Sevens, there's a jobless army at my door. Sfunum Sevens.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. You might have found yourself talking to a technician in India the last time you had to get help with your computer or fax machine. All types of jobs, from technology service to telemarketing, are being outsourced there. Now you can add childbearing to that list. Some childless couples in Europe and the U.S. are hiring Indian women as surrogate mothers to bear children for them. Anush Chopra reported this story for the Christian Science Monitor. He explains how it all works.
The clinic I went to has a website. The popularity of the website seems to be catching on. So a lot of people get in touch with the clinic, with the gynecologists over there, and they say that we want to come down. We have couples from the United States who visit that place, and then they scan various surrogate mothers who are associated to that clinic.
So the couple from the U.S. actually gets to go and choose their mother?
Absolutely, absolutely. They go, they check whether the woman has had children of her own. They check if she does, the health of the child, were there any abnormalities. They check the background of the woman. So they have access to everything in terms of choosing the woman, choosing a surrogate mother.
They're renting a womb in a way.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's like the parents remain the same, But the whole pregnancy, 9 months, is dealt by another woman.
Now, you went to the clinic, as you said, and you met some of the women who are offering their services as surrogates. Can you tell us a little about these women, why they do it?
One of the women who I was interviewing had an interesting background. Her three sisters are also surrogate mothers, and her sister-in-law is also a surrogate mother. Why they do it? This woman, for instance, her husband earns around $50 a month, which is about 2,000 Indian rupees. She has two children and she wants to educate them. It's not a lot of money for a good life in that country. So you get anywhere between 200,000 Indian rupees for renting your womb for 9 months. And they think, no, it's not such a bad idea. They also look at it as if in an altruistic way, you know, that they're helping out childless couples who don't really have any glimmer of hope. But you probe them a little and you know that money is a big motivation.
You know, these are very poor women. I have to say this whole process seems rather exploitative.
If you speak to the doctor at the clinic, you know, she has an interesting explanation. She says it's not really like donating a kidney where, you know, you can be forced into it. A 9-month pregnancy, she says, no woman can be forced into it. So exploitative would be if a woman's being forced into surrogacy, which isn't the case. They're doing it voluntarily.
Is it really voluntary when you're desperate for money and a Western couple offers you so much money to do something that puts your health at risk?
I'm actually not sure if the health is so much at risk because they're taken care of. These couples pay them for their upkeep during the 9 months.
Mm-hmm. But every pregnancy, no matter how well you're fed or treated, carries its risks.
Right, it does. I think the main issue about surrogacy is whether these women get attached to their babies.
That is an interesting issue. Did you talk to any of the women about that?
You talk to a lot of these women and they have this attitude that this isn't our baby and it isn't for us to keep. Even the doctors at the clinic say that, you know, they haven't really encountered a woman who's got too attached to a baby. You know, there was research by a university in the United Kingdom and they'd interviewed surrogate mothers in Britain to check how much they get attached to a baby and if that's a big issue. And they found that in most cases it's pretty easy going. I think the opinion of gynecologists at the clinic in India that I went to shared the same sort of a notion.
How large is this practice?
It seems to be a 20 billion rupees industry by some estimates. It'd be around $450 million.
Wow.
It's that big. And I think, if I'm not wrong, the cases for surrogacy have doubled in the last 2 years.
Anuj, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
Anuj Chopra reported this story for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Boston. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. As we've just heard, couples in the West sometimes go to great lengths to have a child. In the developing world, it's not uncommon to find families with large numbers of children. That's because adults count on their sons and daughters to contribute to the family income. But being a child in a large family isn't always easy, especially when money is scarce. Dave Snyder works with Catholic Charities. He was recently in Ghana, and he sent us this aid worker diary.
David Mbamba is a bartender in the dusty town of Dimongo in northern Ghana. Every evening he serves drinks to tired travelers at the small guest house where he works, not far from a large national park. David is quiet and friendly, with a smoky baritone voice and the patient look of a skillful listener. On the night I stayed at the guest house, I was his only patron. Beneath a full moon, clouded by dusty winds, we shared the details of our lives. David was the third of seven siblings. His family put all of their resources into educating his eldest brother, but after his brother graduated from college, he died suddenly, and with him went the money he was sending home. Now the whole family works to keep his second eldest brother in school, so for David, the chance for an education is not likely to come. The 24-year-old bears the weight of his circumstances with quiet dignity. He works 7 days a week and saves, in the best months, $10 from his wages. He saves nothing, he says, if there is trouble. His life now is full of ifs, which he offers not as complaint, but only as fact. If he had $300, he could go to school for 2 years to learn computers. If he had $100 more, he could buy a used computer to practice. Then he could get a job, he says, and get married. $400 to change his life. I sit quietly in the moonlight, turning that number over in my head, embarrassed suddenly at my $7 meal and my $2 beer, almost his monthly savings. But, he adds quietly, glancing off towards the lone light of the nearby kitchen, you must cut your coat to fit your cloth. We talked for a while more about crops and animals and the one trip David took to Accra, the capital, as a schoolboy. When I finished my beer, we shook hands, and I thanked him for talking with me. I set off towards the guest house, my steps swallowed in the soft red sand, and left David alone wiping plastic tables with a damp rag, cutting his coat, night by night, to fit his cloth.
David Snyder is a writer and photographer based in Baltimore. In most of Africa, honoring the dead with a lavish ceremony is common, despite a family's modest circumstances. It's a mark of respect. It also reflects the family's standing in society. And in Ghana, funerals have spawned an unusual profession. Correspondent Prue Clark sent us this reporter's notebook.
Ghanaian Christian funerals are never somber affairs. After three raucous days of singing and dancing, St. Peter is well and truly aware this Ghanaian soul is on its way to the pearly gates. So I was not surprised when one recent day a parade of mourners dressed in traditional red and black came singing and dancing down my street. I headed out of my hotel to watch. But as the procession passed and the coffin came into view, my jaw hit the ground. Riding toward me, atop a sea of mourners, was a great big orange lobster. Why a lobster? I asked the Ghanaian friend who joined me. Because he was a lobster seller, he replied. Of course. In this peculiarly Ghanaian tradition, loved ones are buried in a coffin custom designed to reflect the dead person's trade. A carpenter might be buried in a giant hammer, a minister in a giant Bible, a chicken farmer in a giant... Well, you get the picture. I've come here to Nungwa on the outskirts of the capital, Accra, to visit the man who made that lobster and find out more about this tradition. This is the showroom of Joseph Tetta, or Pa Joe as he's known. It's filled with coffin-sized replicas of Coca-Cola and beer bottles, Nikes. There's even a Mercedes-Benz over here with incredible detail. Rear-view mirrors with real glass, mud flaps and license plates. Pa Joe is the best of the custom coffin makers by his own humble estimation and a direct descendant of the man who started this tradition, carpenter Atta Wu. Pa Joe, what's the idea behind these coffins?
So it's a profession. Maybe you are a journalist. You can make a pen coffin.
If you're a journalist, he says, you can be buried in a pen coffin or perhaps a camera.
So you could make me a microphone?
Yeah.
So, but I understand the tradition started 50 years ago.
50 years ago.
Tell me about that.
When your grandmother died, we look in the different coffin nobody will see before.
She'd always wanted to travel, but never made it. So Atta Wu got the idea to make her an airplane coffin. He made her a perfect 737 to fly to the next world. People were impressed and a tradition was born. Downstairs in the workshop here, Pa Joe has six apprentice boys working on a coffin in the shape of a bundled fishing net. The work is furious. The coffin's owner, a fisherman, is to be buried in just 3 days. But some of Joe's masterpieces take months to make. No problem, says Joe. The body goes on ice until he's finished. The coffins don't come cheap. The starting price is $400, more than the average Ghanaian makes in a year. But honouring the dead is so important here that families will find the money, even if it means bankruptcy. Much of Joe's work goes overseas these days to amused expats who use them as novelty wardrobes and toy boxes. But don't tell Pa Joe. To him, this is serious art, and his buyers are fine collectors.
So not money. But I enjoy the idea that God will give me, the talent God will give me. I'm lucky.
Joe says his work is not about the money. It comes from his heart and from God. Anything you can think of, he tells me, I can make it.
I'm trying to think of something to challenge you. Do you know what a kangaroo looks like?
That was correspondent Prue Clark, who, as you might have guessed, hails from Australia. Lorenzo Ortiz is short on sleep. That's because he works two jobs. By day, he's a construction worker. And by night, he's a security guard patrolling the streets of Jalapa, Mexico. But Lorenzo Ortiz doesn't earn a salary for doing his night job. He depends on the charity of those he's protecting. Conrad Fox brings us this report on a night in the life of a night watchman.
It's 10 o'clock on a Thursday night. Lorenzo Ortiz shines a flashlight down a dark alley in a slum on the wrong side of Jalapa's tracks.
Look, if a gangster came out of there, well... But thank God, nothing. We're okay.
Then he moves on. Ortiz wears a policeman's uniform, but he's just a private licensed security guard. One of some 60 with a permit to patrol this city streets at night. Like many such patrolmen around the country, he's not paid a salary, but from donations he collects from the people he protects. 7 days a week, from 9 p.m. until 5 in the morning, Ortiz and two companions walk Jalapa's most dangerous neighborhood, looking for muggers, burglars, and other troublemakers. So far tonight, he's just encountered lots of stray dogs. 45-year-old Ortiz is slightly built, and armed only with a baton, a weapon he admits he hasn't fully mastered. He started this job a year ago to supplement his earnings from his trade as a construction worker. He's got a family of 8 to feed, but he's lighthearted about the odds against him. Casually waving away a dog with his flashlight, he says he's not scared.
No. Yo me aviento la chamba como...
I love this job. It's healthy. Look at all the walking we're doing. You meet all sorts of people, some of them good and some of them bad.
As he walks, he blows his whistle, in theory to scare away burglars and other evildoers. A few short blasts, and two companions patrolling a few blocks away will come to his aid. If they do run into a bad guy, they'll most likely call in the regular police by cell phone. So far, Lorenzo has had no serious run-ins with criminals. At about midnight, he heads down the train track dividing this neighborhood from the rest of the city. Tin lean-tos line the path, dirt-poor families asleep inside. Ortiz says the poverty here goes hand in hand with drug and alcohol addiction, but he has little sympathy.
They're people who don't like to work. They'd rather just sit back and have a few drinks.
Lorenzo is no stranger to poverty. Between his job as a construction worker and night watchman, he only makes about $500 a month, and sometimes much less. But he takes it in stride.
If there's a bit of money, we'll get a chicken. Or we eat eggs, beans, and salsa sometimes. We're like an accordion, stretching and shrinking.
Lorenzo stops occasionally to listen. He says he can hear a strange police whistle somewhere in the distance. It isn't coming from his partners, he says. Suddenly, he heads urgently towards an intersection a block away. Getting closer, I can hear a heated argument and make out 4 figures in the pale streetlight. 2 are Lorenzo's partners. The other 2 are dressed in jeans and ripped t-shirts. Police batons are stuffed clumsily into their belts. Lorenzo's companions have stumbled across competition. Pirate night guardians, who have recently begun to patrol this zone without a city permit. Tomorrow, they will ask for donations from residents, the same people Lorenzo hopes will pay him. Lorenzo's group asks the intruders to leave, but are met with threats of violence. One tries to hit the microphone from my hand. When the patrolmen call the regular police by cell phone, the intruders begin to walk away. Casually at first, then ever faster. A bizarre pursuit begins with Lorenzo following them from a distance. He hopes to indicate their location to the police, if the police ever show up. After 20 minutes, they're nowhere to be seen, and he gives up the chase.
Pues se siente uno mal.
It makes you feel really bad. You've spent so long working the zone. Then they come in and take it from us. They patrol for one night, then start asking people for donations the next day. It confuses people, and then they don't want to pay anyone.
After the chase, I'm exhausted. But it's only 3 a.m., and there's still 2 hours left on the shift.
Hey.
Lorenzo continues hiking the steep roads of his zone with the same energy as before. But his buoyant manner has left him. At 5 in the morning, as we say goodbye where the railroad track crosses a main avenue, he finally admits to fear.
Those two guys weren't happy. What will happen tomorrow? Well, we'll have to see.
At midday the next day, the same neighborhood is now full of life. Lorenzo has slept a few hours and is preparing to go door to door to ask residents for donations. He carries cheaply printed receipts with him and asks for 5 pesos, about 50 cents. He doesn't knock on every door.
Lo que pasa que hay casas que no cooperan, por ejemplo, aquí en esta no nos cooperan.
Not everyone gives. I can tell you that house doesn't. That one doesn't. And that one doesn't. So we don't go everywhere. Why bother?
Some people are happy to see him, like this woman, Elba Carranza. She says her neighborhood is becoming ever more dangerous.
At night, we almost don't go out. You can't say anything because you don't want to suffer revenge. And patrol cars don't come by here anymore. Just this man. We hear him every night. Someone looking out for us.
But only about 1 in 4 gives him anything.
Look, this is an idea of how much we make. $2 for 2 streets. There's times when you say, to come back home with this little money? You saw last night all we walked. It's a lot of work.
By 2 o'clock, the sun is blazing and Lorenzo is still tired from last night's patrol. He decides to head home for a meal before going out on patrol again tonight. The bus ride to his house costs him a fifth of what he has just earned. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Jalapa, Mexico.
There's more to come. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Julia Nagahu has a dangerous job in a dangerous city. She's a taxi driver in Nairobi, Kenya, a city so rife with crime, the locals call it Nairobbery. Nagahu reluctantly got into the taxi business 2 years ago. She's only one of a handful of women daring enough to take on the job. In a city where carjackings are as common as gassing up, drivers need their wits about them. Reporter Sonia Varma buckled up next to Nagahu to see how she steers clear of trouble on the streets of Nairobi.
Thousands of taxis navigate Nairobi's chaotic streets. Julia Nagahu's black Toyota is one of them. As she pushes through downtown traffic, Nagahu issues a warning to her customer, who's unfamiliar with the city.
At night, don't try walking there.
Nagahu passes a street sign that cautions drivers about carjackings. A few feet later, another billboard reads, "Beware the human dog. This is a rape hotspot. You are likely to be raped here." You might think this sign marks a dark alley, but the warnings are scattered around Nairobi's downtown, a signal that these are dangerous streets. But Nagahu doesn't need reminding. She says almost every month she hears of an attack on a taxi driver.
As I'm talking today, yesterday somebody was taken and we still is not known where he is. The car was found, but he cannot be seen. That was yesterday.
46-year-old Nagahu is a rare breed in the business. There are fewer than 10 women driving taxis in all of Nairobi. Most Kenyan men wouldn't want their wife or girlfriend driving a taxi, especially when a rape reportedly occurs here every 30 seconds. But Nagahu has no husband to tell her no or to rely on.
This is very dangerous, but I just don't want to clothe myself in fear. And then not able to pay my bills, not able to have food. So you take risk, you take chances. Life goes on.
Nagahu never imagined she'd be shuttling tourists and business people from place to place for a living. As a child, she dreamed of being a doctor. But her parents put no value on educating girls. She did manage to get a good job with a Catholic charity. After 12 years and a promotion, she'd saved enough to open up her own business. So, 7 years ago, Nagahu moved back to her home province and set up a corner store. Then, 3 years ago, her luck took a bad turn.
I got sick, very sick in the year 2002, which I had 3 operations in 3 months, and that cost my business, my savings, and everything else I had.
Nagahu, a divorcee, was left with a small house and car. With little education, she saw only 2 options: sell the car for some money, or use the car to make some.
By the way, this Gong Hills, you have ever seen the Out of Africa movie?
Out of Africa, yeah.
Yes, those are the hills you see.
Driving eco-tourists around is one thing, but early on in the job, Nagahu saw the seedy side of driving a taxi. Nagahu soon learned that many of her colleagues cater to clients of Nairobi's sex trade, but she steers clear of it. Instead, Nagahu pays for a spot at Kenya's international airport. She lines up there at 5 a.m. along with 700 other taxis jockeying for business.
There are also camping sites there. Such places.
Nagahu drops off a family of tourists at Nairobi's famous carnivore restaurant. She wanted more for herself in life, but her lack of education held her back.
I usually say it's not like there was no money. There was no will. Although I did insist that I wanted to get education. I was good in school. I would not claim to be a genius, but if I went to books, I come out with something. I never failed my primary school education, which I worked for it myself. I started working when I was 6 years old in people's farms. This is not very easy for me.
The memory of the lost opportunity still brings her to tears.
Hello. Tiko rute farai. Nikin mana dena koya. Okay.
Customer?
Yes, customer. He's telling me to pick him at 6.
In recent months, Nagahu's managed to build up a sizable and fairly regular client base. With the airport and her private customers, she's able to pull in over $1,000 a month. Nagahu calls it survival money, because there's not much left over after she pays for gas and other expenses, and she's trying to save for a new car. Nagahu admits it's not an easy way to make a living. There are always slow times and rude customers, but there are also busy days and big tippers.
Sometimes you feel encouraged, sometimes you feel very discouraged, but I believe in going on and fighting on. That I believe.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Sonia Varma in Nairobi, Kenya.
Few of us think much about where our neighborhood garbage trucks take the trash. Most garbage dumps in this country are out of public view and carefully regulated. It's not the same in the developing world, where mountains of trash can be found right outside the city. Scavengers work on these dumps, collecting and selling what they've found for recycling. Reporter Matthew Power visited a dump called Payadas in the Philippines. He told us what it was like.
You go through a gate and you walk up this path that's essentially carved into the garbage, and you can feel the ground sort of quaking underneath your feet as you walk up it. And it's kind of primordial. There's puddles with bubbles of methane bubbling up through them. You wind your way up to the top of the hill, and it's a really big hill, and then get to the top, which is where the new garbage is being dumped. Most of the organic stuff is rotted away, but it's just this like compressed garbage. And then you get to the top, and it's all this new stuff, so it's very bright colors and plastic and swarms of people going over it.
what kind of health problems do you see in the community of scavengers?
A lot of air quality things are a big problem. So a lot of the children have asthma, skin diseases. It's very easy to get tetanus. It's very easy to get tuberculosis there. Also, you know, some of the things that scavengers do, like they'll collect wires, plastic-coated wires, and burn them to get the copper on the inside. So they're burning the plastic off. And when you burn plastic wire insulation, it releases dioxin, which is one of the most carcinogenic substances in the world.
Now, you spent 3 weeks at the dump yourself, getting to know some of these people. There are 10,000 of them. Where do they come from?
In general, the people that I met were there by their own choice, and a lot of them had come from the hinterlands of the Philippines. This is really a global phenomenon right now, which is driving these hugely expanding economies in China and India and the Philippines, and all over the world is this massive urban migration that's going on now. Millions and millions of people are moving from the countrysides and from lives as subsistence farmers to these enormous expanding megacities. The fastest growing cities in the world, of which Manila is one of them, are almost all in the developing world. So you have this huge population of people who were agrarians, were farmers, and are now moving to cities and trying to find some way to survive.
How can you actually make a living by picking through a dump? I mean, do they make enough to survive?
You'd be surprised, actually. The average scavenger in Manila makes about twice the national average. That average is skewed low because many, many millions of people in the Philippines are subsistence farmers. You make about $3 a day, which obviously sounds sub-poverty here in America, but in the Philippines, it's enough to put food on the table for your family.
After spending some time getting to know the people, how did you read their attitudes? Do they feel like victims?
They don't feel like victims. And I don't know if that's a uniquely sort of optimistic Filipino outlook, because they were very, just generally very positive and funny and sort of had a sense of humor about it. And also kind of a sense of hope that they would find something really, really good in the garbage. They had karaoke machines on the dump. They would just stop in the middle of their shifts and go and sing karaoke. And there's this kind of joy that they had distilled out of their existence. And I found it to be incredibly inspiring.
From what you write, these scavengers actually perform a kind of strangely important job, like recycling.
The estimate of one study that I read was that about 25% of the waste stream in the Philippines gets diverted. So essentially, you know, you have, say, 1 million tons of garbage a year coming out of a certain city. These people were taking 250,000 tons of that and putting it back, and it gets reused, it gets melted down and turned into other things, and paper they save, all sorts of things that they save. It's essentially a public service. And I guess what I was hoping out of this, that it would be recognized as such by the government there, and that people would actually be given some sort of legitimacy. And then they would have the right to unionize and do collective bargaining and really be a force in controlling their own destinies.
Any hope of that?
Well, I mean, they're starting small, and it's definitely a long process.
All right. Matthew Power, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Matthew Power's story on the Payadas dump was published in Harper's Magazine. To read it, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. On a shady corner in the city of Phnom Penh, a small outdoor cafe serves coffee. Reporter Megan Williams discovered the place on one of her first days in the Cambodian capital. In the beginning, it was the coffee that brought her back. Then it was the story of the owner.
It's a brilliantly sunny afternoon in downtown Phnom Penh, Cambodia's sprawling capital. I've just finished an interview with the man who offers to buy me a coffee at a nearby stand. Dozens of cars are parked on a dusty lot to the side. This is where the city's taxi drivers hang out, waiting for work. Like so many of the businesses in this struggling city, the cafe consists of improvised comfort. Worn plastic chairs and tables set up under the shade of a leafy tree. A little stand holds an old-fashioned ice box and a gas burner to make the drinks. The coffee is served in a tall glass with a long spoon. It's unapologetically dense and sweet, with a thick dollop of condensed milk on the bottom. Pure bliss. Tucked behind the stand is a raised wooden platform. That's where the woman who runs the cafe rests under an umbrella. Her name is Savon. I learned this the next morning from a taxi driver who speaks English. She's an attractive woman in her late 40s, with olive-weathered skin, erect posture, and alert eyes. There's also a constant unspoken sadness flickering in them. Later, the cabbie translates as I chat with Savon over lemonade, which is every bit as good as her coffee. Like almost every Cambodian over the age of 40 or so, Savon is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge, the brutal regime of the late 70s that murdered, starved, and overworked up to 2 million people. Savon was the only one of her family to survive. For more than two decades, she worked in a family-owned restaurant across the street. Savon also slept there, so when the restaurant closed down about a year ago, she was desperate. Cambodia is still a country of broken lives and haunting memories, but it's also a place where people look out for each other. The cab drivers, who were regulars at the restaurant, pulled together to help Savon. They cleared away a corner of the lot where they parked their cars and helped Savon set up her mini kitchen and plastic furniture the owners had left her. They pitched in to buy her some umbrellas for extra shade. They helped her set up the wooden platform where she sleeps each night. Despite the lack of walls and locked door, Savon says she feels safe. During my stay in Phnom Penh, I went back to that stand each day, and as I sat on one of Savon's plastic chairs and sipped my morning coffee, I felt as I often do when people struggling to get by share a small slice of their life with me. Grateful. And, of course, also grateful for the best cup of coffee in all of Phnom Penh.
That was reporter Megan Williams. If you'd like to see a photo of Savon at her coffee stand, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. There's an upscale restaurant in Montreal where the waiters work for free. It's called Robin de Bois. That's Robin Hood in French. Judith Ritter checked out this trendy eatery that feeds the rich and gives its profits to the poor.
Robin de Bois, bonsoir.
It's not easy to get a reservation at Montreal's hot new eatery, Robin de Bois. Tonight, this sleek bistro's packed. Even big-name actors and directors are on a waiting list. Not just to dine, but to work so that money saved on wages can be donated to the poor.
Tonight is my first night.
A little scared?
Yeah, I'm scared.
Catherine Pilon usually directs music videos for Quebec's version of MTV. Clearly, she's more comfortable giving orders than taking them.
I'd like to know what you put in your boudin créole.
Good question. For me, it's my first time. Oh, my God. I'll be right back.
She hasn't a clue. But the diners celebrating a birthday are unfazed. They know the servers are volunteers, and they know the profits go to local charities. They've also heard that a server spilling a glass of water might even be a local media heartthrob.
Patrice Cocquereau was here. He's one of the most famous actors in Quebec. And he was here, just serving on the tables. And obviously, people were just actually freaking out.
That's TV personality Philippe Femieux. His wife, Judy Servais, is the mastermind behind the Robin Hood restaurant. The idea caught on with their glittery acquaintances, and now there's a waiting list of 1,400 doctors, artists, and actors all ready to wait tables, wash dishes, and chop vegetables for free. The chefs get paid, but not what they're used to. But for Chef Sebastian Corville, that's just fine.
It touched me every day because they give to the community. I really love it.
And while other restaurants struggle for financing, not this place, a local bank gave, yes, gave them $25,000 to start up. And after just 4 months, Robin Dubois is in the black. So soon, the hotspot will turn over its first profits to a homeless shelter, a project for street kids, and a food bank. In the meantime, show business folks are working hard to master a new profession.
Okay, one boudin créole. And something to drink?
Over at the birthday table, the music video director turned server is getting a little smoother.
I'll be better maybe by the third table. What do you think?
Good luck, Catherine. Just don't quit your day job. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Montreal.
Bonne fête, Hélène. Bonne fête, Hélène. Bonne fête, Hélène. Et
And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can find out more about the program and where to find us at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can listen to the show there, or you can podcast it if you want to take us with you. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.